Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. In our next and final conversation with Dr. Jonathan Stapley, we're going to talk about sealing, not just any sealing, but we're going to talk about sealing from child to parent. We'll also bring in some more Protestant terminology, such as Calvinism and Arminianism. So I'll let Dr. Stapley talk a little bit more about those in just a minute. But we'll talk about a specific case of John D. Lee. He was sealed to Brigham Young as an adopted child. Despite his participation in the Mormon Meadows Massacre, is his fate in heaven sealed? Check out our conversation. Hey, I just wanted to add a couple other things. Our latest transcript with Jonathan Stapley is out, so you can get that on our Amazon webpage, or you can subscribe monthly here for just $10 a month, and I will send it to you as soon as it's released. So anyway, I'll be sending that out to our monthly subscribers, so just go to our website, gospeltangents.com, and click on the subscribe button for $10 a month. I will send this and all future transcripts out as soon as they're finished. Now back to our conversation.
So I have a chapter on the sealing ritual. I do not quote from the sealing text, but you know, Orson Pratt published the sealing text in New York, of all places. And it was in his paper called The Seer. Brigham Young found out and was kind of bent out of shape. But Rodman finally said, well, I guess it's not that big of a deal that you did it. I don't quote from the text, but it that particular ritual has been public for a long time. We also have an 1842 sealing text that Joseph Smith delivered to the Whitney family, and that's online at the Church History Library.
Are those early sealing texts very similar to what we do today in the temple? No, they're very different.
Yeah, so the 1842 text is very different than the 1852 text, which Orson Pratt published.
And I guess, is that considered public domain now? Because it's so old?
Yeah, you know, church leaders, yeah, it's open. Look, if you, people will get bent out of shape if you quote the sealing text. The 1842 text, I think, is less sensitive because it's so dissimilar from current practice. And it will be in the Joseph Smith papers, the 1842 text, in the document series. And so that one I do actually quote from extensively in my book, because it shows the work that was being done in a tremendously helpful way. The current, like I said, people get bent out of shape when you quote from the temple liturgy to any extent today. And I am sensitive to the boundaries of my community. And perhaps that influences the types of topics I choose to write about. But I haven't run into that problem thus far.
All right. Well, since we mentioned sealing, can you talk a little bit about what did you talk about in your book about sealing and how it relates to liturgy?
Yeah, so the prime argument I'm making in that chapter, chapter two, about sealing is that, and this is I tend to think that there was this flourish of temple studies in the 1980s. That projected a lot of 20th century thought onto the Nauvoo era. And perhaps my chapter two is a reaction to that a little bit. But what I'm trying to do is, again, what did sealings do in the 19th century and through the 20th century? And what we find is that sealings, I use the term perseverance, which is another term that's not super familiar to Mormons, but is incredibly familiar to Christianity more generally. Perseverance is the idea, as codified in the Westminster Confession, which Mormons hate, that once you are saved, you cannot completely or entirely fall from grace.
So now Bill and I had a talk about that. Yeah. I don't know if you were able to see that interview, but he's because It's funny that you say that Mormons would not like the Westminster Confession, because according to Dr. Smith, a sealing was basically permanent.
That's right. So that's an argument I make. And, you know, Bill and I are friends, and we've talked about these topics a lot. So I think we tread similar ground a little bit mm-hmm. in this area. But yeah, my argument is that, and it's really, there's strong evidence, multiple documentary sources, let alone Section 132 that Bill writes about extensively, that sealings constructed heaven. And they were sure you could not break the sealing unless the person that holds the authority to create seals dissolves them. And so, I mean, there's no other way to read 132 that's remotely sensible. But there's other sources. Joseph Smith sermonizes about these topics. There's letters, journals, entries. People are emphatic that not only marriage sealings as husbands and wife, but sealings to children create bonds that cannot be broken, because to use my cosmological priesthood, they create the structure of heaven. This is the cosmological priesthood. The heaven is constitutive, or constituted of these sealing bonds, these relationships that endure. And so if you think of it that way, it makes sense that, oh yeah, of course they're sure, right? In spite of earth and hell, to quote, or to paraphrase Section 132. And the problem with that is that universally, people are creeps, right? Mm-hmm. So immediately, we have to deal with the reality that we're all kind of jerks, and we do not only just kind of stupid stuff, but sometimes really terrible, horrible things. And so perseverance, we take a step away from it a little bit. The perseverance of children to parents perhaps endures the longest. And to the 20th century, mid-20th century, where folks like Elder McConkie are just horrified by the idea that someone could get away with something. And so the idea of perseverance is counted among his seven deadly heresies. But I think that that pendulum has swung back in certain quarters, but not all. Elder Bednar recently wrote in the Ensign disclaiming the perseverance of child-to-parent sealings. So we'll see where it goes.
Well, so, you know, let's just take a hypothetical, either modern day or even, you know, Joseph Smith's day. You have parents sealed in the temple. Their children are born in the covenant. The child chooses, hey, I don't believe in Mormonism anymore. Mm-hmm. I don't want to do that. You know, let's say they get excommunicated. According to early, say, 1840-ish theology, that bond can never be broken between parent and child?
That's right. Or husband and wife, for that matter.
Okay. Yeah. And then, okay. So then what about now? We don't believe that anymore, do we?
I think most people, I think it's complicated. I think because there's been this long tradition of, especially in the early 20th century, Orson F. Whitney paraphrased Joseph Smith and talked about the tentacles of providence that would reach out to our children that had been led astray and slowly bring them back to us. And man, church leaders have loved that. Even up to the most recent church leaders have quoted that Orson F. Whitney statement, General Conference statement, because it is so comforting to parents that struggle with their children who disbelieve. At the same time, you have folks that just, it bugs them, that the idea that anybody could get away with sin of any sort. And so you have this tension, and it's resolved in different ways among different schools of thought. And I think there are strong schools of thought. I mentioned another Bednar, who I think is indicative of one of those strains that would suggest that, look, yeah, you are, it's entirely contingent on your faith. And there's, it's just like a parent could pray for their kids to accept the gospel today, that option will be open to them for eternity.
All right. And then we'll finish this off with this one last question. Off camera, we were talking a little bit about Calvinism and Arminianism and, mm-hmm. and the sealing power. Mm-hmm. Could you describe those?
So this goes back to our discussion on perseverance. And Justice Smith framed, when he talked about the sealing, he framed them between Calvinism and Arminianism. So on the one hand, Calvinism is this idea that, you know, tulip in our modern perspective, you know, once you're saved, you are saved always, and you cannot fall from grace. And Arminians were like, well, you can certainly backslide. Like, you can be saved and then screw up and backslide. And the challenge is that for everybody, for every Christian, no matter what sort of philosophical theology you adhere to, is that we all know folks that are burning converts, that are regenerated, that have the faith, and that also end up being just complete jerks and falling away, right? And the Calvinist would perhaps say, well, he never really was saved in the first place. He was never elect, right? And the Methodist or the Arminian would say, well, he was certainly saved, but he then backslid and fell from grace. And the question is, he explicitly referenced, Joseph Smith explicitly references these two ideas and then places sealing in between. And I think how one way to think about this is that sealings, in as much as they materialized heaven, they created literally heaven. It doesn't exist anywhere outside of the creation of these sealed networks. If I am sealed into the network of heaven, I have a place there. And then if I backslide, so the discussion of these early sealings being persevering, that once you are part of heaven, you cannot be taken away. You persevere in heaven. The idea is, in at least in section 132, is that you can backslide, but your place is heaven is still there. And there is strong language, the destruction of flesh, and all these like warnings, right? But that you would be returned to your place in the sealed network of heaven. And that, I think what he is doing and what he's saying is that, we're jerks. We fall, we screw up. And hell is being separated. But that... ultimately, we will choose redemption. Right? Even the backslider can be redeemed, and when he is redeemed, he or she finds their place in the sealed network of heaven where it was. So that's at least my reading of perseverance. So there's no question that Joseph Smith is teaching perseverance of the sealed relationships, that the temple work after he's dead is referencing this, and that's how the Latter-day Saints are viewing sealings of marriage, child to parent sealings, any temple sealing, that's how they're viewing it. But obviously, the ineptitude and just plain meanness of humanity overwhelms that quite rapidly.
Mm-hmm. So where do Mormons, it seems like you said that Mormons tried to bridge that gap between Calvinism and Arminianism?
Right, so on the one hand, once you're saved, you're saved, right? Once you're sealed, you're sealed. You cannot be unsealed unless someone does that, right? But you persevere within the network of heaven. But on the Arminian side, yeah, you can backslide. You can fall from that. But you must, there's consequence and payment. Like, you have to, it's not like you get away scot-free. You experience suffering when you disassociate yourself from the sealed network of heaven, and you must again accept Christ to be redeemed and regain your place.
So this would this be, is this what with Dr. Smith when we talked about enduring to the end. And the idea is, if we can endure to the end, we'll be saved. I'm not sure I'm following you.
Well, so ultimately, perseverance is challenging, because you have, like, Brigham Young. He's got John D. Lee, right, who participates in a mass murder, innocence. He's an adopted son of Brigham Young, not in a civil sense, but he is sealed to Brigham Young mm-hmm. as a son with his spouse, as a daughter of Brigham Young. And so Brigham Young has to wrestle with this. Well, is this a persevering relationship? And faced with that reality, he says, no. You guys have to, he gets up and he's like, oh, you people that are sealed to me, you can't get on my coattails. You have to do your work, right? But on the one hand, but on the other hand, he's saying, my kids are totally in.
So is John D. Lee in heaven then? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know. I mean, that's, so that's.
So you're just leaving this as a, this is just a hard question to answer?
No, it's just that, the way we deal with perseverance shifts. So, like, I have no idea who's in heaven or not, or what's, you know, what I can talk about is how Mormons at certain instances conceived of the work of sealing. Right?
To pull somebody like John D. Lee in.
Right.
But now we're not quite so sure.
Brigham Young says, you know, he's doing his own thing. He's not part of my spiel. And today, I think there's no question that church leaders are fairly unanimous that, like, look, you don't get off scot-free, right? If you do stuff like that, you're on your own.
So we would lean more towards the Arminian side.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. For sure. Yeah, I think the way we talk about sealings today is very much closer to Protestant ideas of heaven today. So heaven now, the celestial kingdom, is something you get if you're faithful. It's a reward that you get later. It's not something we make today in the temple. I think that's, demonstrably true.
Okay. All right. Any last thoughts before I let you go?
I don't know. Thank you for your time and fun conversation.
All right. Well, thanks. Everybody go out and buy Jonathan's book. It's a great book and a short read, a lot shorter than some other Mormon history books out there. So
I wanted to make it accessible.
Well, great. Well, thanks for participating here on Gospel Tangents.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Stapley. I know I learned a lot, and I hope you did too. Thanks, Jonathan. I really appreciate all your spending time with us. In our next conversation, I'd like to introduce George Throckmorton. He's the police officer who figured out how Mark Hoffman was forging his documents. It turns out that it's not just Mark Hoffman that he was involved with. In this next little snippet, we're going to talk a little bit about a murder. If you're from Utah, you've probably heard of it, the Hi-Fi Shop murders. It was a terrible thing. But George says that there was forgeries going on with that as well. So check this out.
In order for the cars to go back east, they had to have two sets of keys. And Pierre could only find one set of keys. So he went out to the base and got a duplicate set of keys made. He had to sign for that. And I actually was attached his signature to request for the extra set of keys on that investigation when the Hi-Fi Shop murders happened. And me and the... we had been investigating that already, and he was a suspect in that murder.
I hope you enjoyed that little snippet of George Throckmorton. We're going to release these, just as we always have. But for those of you who want the whole thing, unedited, all in one piece, it's about a two-hour interview. We've now got a Patreon page at patreon.com/gospeltangents. If you want to hear the entire unedited, well, minimally edited interview, it's about 2 hours long, then go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents. For $5 a month, you can get this and all future interviews completely edited before we release them out to everybody else. So it's audio only, but for those of you who, especially if you have a long drive in the car, you can get the entire interview. So check that out, patreon.com/gospeltangents. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure that you like our page on facebook.com/gospeltangents. You can subscribe at YouTube at youtube.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at gospeltangents, as well as make sure that you subscribe on iTunes so you don't miss any of our episodes. Thanks again for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our videos. Thanks again.